This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actor and writer Danny McBride. Last summer, he was in two hit films. In the comedy Pineapple Express, a hybrid of a stoner film and an action film, he played a drug dealer who was beaten and shot and shot and shot. But like a lot of characters in far-fetched action films, he just kept on going. In Tropic Thunder, a comedy about actors making a jungle war movie, he played the pyrotechnics expert on the set. McBride co-wrote and starred in the comedy The Foot Fist Way as the narcissistic head of a martial arts school for kids. Now he's starring in the HBO comedy series Eastbound and Down, which premiered last Sunday. He plays Kenny Powers, a relief pitcher famous for his fastball and his big mouth. When he loses his fastball and becomes even more obnoxious, he finds himself exiled from the major leagues. He reluctantly takes a job as the substitute gym teacher in his old middle school. Here he is in front of his first class.
What's up? I'm Kenny Powers. I'll be your new PE teacher till Coach Booth's back is fixed. Yeah, I'm famous, la-di-da, big deal. Now, this time, I'd like to field any questions anybody has. This is the time to do it. You, big kid.
Do we have to run the mile?
I'm talking about me. These are questions about me personally as a superstar. You know, you got this moment in time here with an American icon. You're going to waste it asking a question about the mile? Next question.
Is it true you were in jail?
Nah, babe, rehab.
Did you hurt yourself?
Nah, I didn't hurt myself.
Because Coach Booth said after his back surgery, he has to go to rehab.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I hurt myself. I hurt my nose. All right, got time for one more. Timid kid.
My dad said you ruined baseball.
You know what? I can already tell that I don't like you. And I'm probably not going to like you, no matter how many pull-ups or push-ups you do. If anybody wants to pick on anybody in class, aim for him, because I ain't watching.
Danny McBride, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe your character of Kenny Powers the way you see him?
Well, Kenny Powers is a mess, I think, first and foremost. He is a burnt-out major league pitcher who lost his fastball, and this show kind of picks up years after his fall from grace. He kind of has run out of options and places to turn, so he finds himself on his brother's couch, substitute teaching gym class at his former middle school back in the town he grew up in.
So how did you and your collaborators come up with the idea for this series?
We came up with it several years ago. Ben Best, who's one of the other creators of the show, he was living in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I at the time was substitute teaching in Virginia. I'd lived in L.A. for a few years and hadn't really got to where I wanted to be, so I had moved back home with my parents and was subbing and bartending and trying to write. And I was over at Ben's house one day in North Carolina visiting, and we were sitting in a baby pool in his backyard, if I recall, and drinking beers and trying to come up with good ideas for TV shows, something that we can make money and pull ourselves out of our current situation. And Kenny Powers was a character that kind of grew up in that baby pool there. And we kind of pocketed the idea for a while. And then we met Will Ferrell and Adam McKay after we did The Foot Fist Way. Then we pitched it to those guys, and they dug it.
So you were a substitute teacher before you started working as an actor and screenwriter. Did you take any experiences from your days as a substitute teacher and put them into Eastbound and Down?
You know, that was one of, the first ideas of where Eastbound came from. Was I remember I was subbing, and I'd been living in L.A. for a few years and really hadn't gotten anywhere. And I went back to substitute teach, and I think I was subbing like for a German class or something. I don't speak German or anything. And I can remember introducing myself to the class on the first day saying, you know, I'm Mr. McBride. And I started to find myself like justifying why I was there to these high school kids who couldn't care less. I was just telling them like, you know, this is just a stop on the way for me. I don't really plan on doing this forever. And I think it was that sort of arrogance, you know, which has kind of inspired Kenny Powers of like, you know, I didn't really mind subbing. I thought it was actually pretty cool, and it gave me some good ideas for writing. But I was just, you know, thinking the whole time, God, if I didn't like doing this, this would be a horrible thing to have to come home and do after you've fallen from grace.
The funny thing is, too, it's such an insult to the students to say, I don't really want to be here. This isn't
exactly.
What I should be doing. I should be doing something much better than this.
than shaping your mind.
Than shaping your mind. Yeah, this is just like an unwanted stop along the way being here with you. Because you get no respect at all as a substitute teacher.
None. All they care about is what kind of car you drive, and yeah, they don't care.
Describe your look in the series and how you came up with it.
You know, Ben Best and Jody Hill, the other creators, and I, you know, surprisingly enough, none of us really know that much about baseball. We always have been like music and film guys ever since we were little. And so, you know, a lot of what we've taken from the show in regards to baseball is just kind of what we've gleaned from headlines or from, you know, spotting baseball cards with just guys who, you know, just look insane. And so, yeah, Kenny Powers, we kind of just got that look from just different players we had seen. He has a nice curly mullet. He has a pretty awesome handlebar mustache. And the curly hair is all mine, but the mullet is not. It was an extension.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I didn't have to wear that.
Glad you're not stuck with the mullet. So when you were planning a film career, did you say to yourself, I think I'd like to play a jerk?
You know, that's what's so crazy is I never really had any ambitions in going into acting at all. I went to the North Carolina School of the Arts, or the film school there, and I met David Gordon Green there and Jody Hill and Ben Best and these guys. And, you know, I was there for directing and writing. And so my plan was always to kind of be behind the camera, and I only stepped in front of the camera just out of necessity. You know, David Green had an actor drop out of his film, All the Real Girls, about a week before they started shooting, and I had written a lot with David, so he kind of got that that I knew this character's sensibilities, and so he just trusted me and pulled me in to do this. And from there, I think, you know, Jody Hill, who directed The Foot Fist Way, he, you know, liked what I did in that and then approached me about writing The Foot Fist Way with him and acting in that. And then from that, it's just all these other opportunities have come from there. So I just figured if it was a way, if me being in the movie added any value at all, it would just be another method for us to get our own material out there.
So how do you like acting?
It's not bad. I mean, you don't have to carry cables and move things around, which is cool. People give you stuff for free, like gum and meals, and I like that. But it's been great. I mean, I do like writing. That's what I think what's so fulfilling about this TV show is, you know, I like the acting. That's great. But the fact that it's like our story and it's something that we've written and produced and seen from page to screen, and there's a real fulfillment in that.
Now, Will Ferrell is one of the producers of Eastbound and Down, and he is in the second episode of the series playing the owner of a local car dealership who pays you very little money to do a guest appearance and sign autographs to promote his cars. So how did you and he get to meet in the first place?
You know, Ben Best, Jody Hill, and myself, we wrote The Foot Fist Way, which got into Sundance in 2006, and the movie didn't get domestic distribution after Sundance. It got international distribution, but we kind of left Sundance with our tail between our legs, still looking for a home for our film. You know, nothing really had kind of come from it. And then one day we just get a phone call that the movie happened to get into Will Ferrell's hands, which blew us away that, you know, we love that guy, that he would have watched our film and that he wanted to actually meet with us and talk about the film. So Jody and myself went to meet Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, and they talked about how much they dug the movie and told us how they were starting this new company, Gary Sanchez, and they wanted to have this be the first film that they released under their banner. So we were, you know, as you can imagine, just completely flipped out. And we just kind of struck a friendship with those guys after that as well, because they're just such cool guys. And I think we have a lot of the same sort of thoughts towards comedy, and we just got along really well. So, you know, that's where a good friendship began from that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Danny McBride, and he's now starring in a series that he also co-writes on HBO called Eastbound and Down. I want to talk to you a little bit about a terrific movie you were in the summer of 2008, Pineapple Express. And in this film, you play a drug dealer who finds herself in the middle of a struggle between your suppliers and two of your customers. The customers are played by Seth Rogen and James Franco. And Seth Rogen has witnessed a murder that the drug suppliers had something to do with, so they're trying to get him. And Seth Rogen and James Franco are trying to get them, and you're just trying to save yourself. So in this one scene, Rogen and Franco come to your home to get information, and you all end up in this huge fist fight and throwing things at each other. Then they tie you up with duct tape to a chair and try to get some information out of you. Here's that scene.
Okay. All right. Okay, I'll talk. Ted Jones, he knows you witnessed the murder. He found your roach. He sent two guys over here, Budlovsky and Matheson, two real big and they're basically out to kill you guys. Yeah, and they're gonna kill me too unless I turn you all over. So you guys are basically
I thought you were my friend.
How many cops does he have on his payroll? Tell us!
Well, there's the woman cop, Carol, and
there's a lady cop.
I don't know, he could have a bunch. I mean, this dude is like super well connected, and he has like a really awesome hideout too. It's pretty badass.
Oh,
What else?
Okay, he's at a war right now with the Asians. They're like in a drug war right now.
What Asians? Indians are technically Asian.
It's true.
What Asians?
I don't know. What Chinese or Korean or
Vietcong?
Little Asian people, like the Asians with the guns and the drugs and not his friends.
you're so funny in this film, and it's a really great film. But, you know, as the movie goes on, things just keep getting worse and worse for you. At the end of this scene, the drug suppliers come in, and of course you immediately tell them where Rogan and Franco are. And then the suppliers end up shooting you twice. And in each scene, you get more and more abused. And by any reasonable standard, you should be dead. But like in a lot of action films, you keep hanging on and you decide to use the pain as a motivator. You strap on some guns and go looking for the bad guys. And I don't know, you didn't plan to be an actor, so you probably didn't study physical comedy. What was it like to do all these comedic fight scenes and probably not have any idea what you were doing?
It was actually great. You know, David Green directed that film, and he's a guy that, I'd gone to film school with, so I'd been working with him for a long time. And, you know, when he sat us down about that fight scene in Pineapple, he's like, you know, I don't want this to look like, you know, Born Supremacy, where you guys are just like amazing fighters. The whole gag with this needs to be you guys lack the ability to knock each other out, and it should just be as sloppy as if this kind of fight really happened. And so that we really realized there was no way for this to really go wrong, because I don't know how to knock somebody out anyway, so I don't have to pretend like I can't fight. And so it took a week to shoot that fight scene, which was crazy. I mean, they walked us through the fight, I think, in about 5 minutes on the stage, and they're like, this is what we're shooting for the next week. So it was literally coming into work every day and just getting the hell beat out of you. And Franco busted that bong over the back of my head and actually split my head open. And Seth, I think, like, broke his finger in that. And, you know, we're going through doors. So there's a lot of bangs and bruises. You felt pretty sore at the end of the day. But it was a good way for us three to bond, Franco and Seth and me. We had a good time doing that. And we would never think about using stuntmen on that.
At the end of the film, the characters you play, your character, Seth Rogen's and James Franco's, you're all like bromosexuals. You're three
That's
guys
right.
who swear to be best friends and tell each other they love each other. And meanwhile, like, you're still wearing like your neck brace and it has a big bloody handprint on it. Your clothes are soaked with blood because you've been shot like 7 times. And did you grow up with that kind of buddy movie?
I did. You know, like, that was one thing I really liked about Pineapple. I felt like it kind of, you know, threw homage to those sort of 80s buddy cop movies without, like, making fun of them. It just kind of became one of those films. And, you know, I dug that. And that last scene, I thought, was just such a nice way to end that film. They didn't really have an ending for the movie, even when we went to shooting it. They had something down, but it was nothing that they were ever planning on shooting. And I guess about 3 weeks before we finished filming, Seth and Evan, the two screenwriters, they came up with this ending. They're like, let's just have these guys sitting in a cafe at the end of the day, and it's as if they just had a wild night on the town, and let's just roll the cameras and you guys just talk about the film. And that's how they shot that. There was no real script or anything. They just set 3 cameras up and made us talk about the whole movie, and then they cut the scene together.
That's great, and that probably adds this little bit of kind of awkwardness that you all feel professing your love for each other and your buddiness. let's talk a little bit about Tropic Thunder. And Tropic Thunder is about actors making a jungle war movie on location, inspired by Rambo and all the other movies like it. And you play the special effects and pyrotechnics expert on the set, so you're the guy who does, like, you know, the dynamite blasts and the fire and the napalm. And I want to play a scene from the film. You're in the jungle talking with the grizzled war hero who's the military consultant for the film. He's played by Nick Nolte. And the movie that you're making is based on his memoir, Tropic Thunder. Here's the clip.
So we got to light these boys up today, huh?
Blow some sense into these young men.
Hey, I don't want to come off as weird or anything, but I might be your biggest fan.
Yeah.
Tropic Thunder.
Kind of like my Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, I've never been in the military per se, but I have lost an appendage in the line of duty. Driving Miss Daisy for a studio gig.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool sidearm you got there.
What is it?
I don't know what it's called. I just know the sound it makes when it takes a man's life.
Okay. Damien, we're go for explosion. Ready to kick the tires and light the fires when you say so. Damien, we're go for explosion.
I love the idea that you, the special effects man, lost a finger in Driving Miss Daisy,
which was a special effects heavy
man.
Film. Of
oh,
course.
That's such a slow moving film about a driver and the woman that he drives. So, what did you learn about pyrotechnics? Playing the pyrotechnics expert.
I learned a lot. I got to shadow the special effects guys, and I learned how to use a flamethrower, which was probably the highlight of my education there. And it was crazy. It was like going to movie star camp. You know, you're there on location in Hawaii, and there's guys from like Nolte to Jack Black to Robert Downey Jr. Everyone has such a different process, and you're sitting there just kind of taking it all in. It was really amazing.
Well, speaking of process, Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder plays an actor, a white actor who's playing an African American. Soldier, and because the character Downey plays is such like the method actor, he starts to convince himself that he is black, and he never gets out of character, so he acts black even when he's not on the set. And since Downey is such an eccentric actor to begin with, what was it like to work with him playing this parody of like the worst cliche of the method actor?
It was pretty amazing. I mean, we would be around Downey all day on the set, and I would just forget it was Downey. You know, at nighttime, you'd see him for dinner and be like, oh, yeah, I keep forgetting that Robert Downey Jr. is in this movie. That's him in the daytime. But, one of the things I remember early on, it was like the second day of filming, I think, and in between takes, the sound guys, they'll usually cut off everybody's mics. But for some reason, I think they had by accident had left Downey's mic on, and I had an earwig in. I could hear what he was saying. He was still mic'd in between the take. And I can remember just like watching him, and I could, I watched him kind of leave the set, and he's like walking back to the trailers, and I'm like, oh, it's crazy, they're leaving his mic on. I can hear him talking to himself, and he was just still in character, going back to his trailer, talking about how he was going to go drain the lizard, and he was just still speaking in his voice from there. It's like he's not dropping it at all. It was pretty impressive.
That's really funny because he's like doing what his character does, which is like staying
exactly.
in character.
He doesn't drop character to the DVD commentary, he says.
That's really so funny. But he's so terrific in it. So were you ever afraid being around any of the fires and explosions in the movie?
The only one that was a little tricky was that first real big explosion in Tropic. They had the rest of the crew like a mile away from the explosion, and I was the closest one to the explosion. They had me up in the tower with the camera guy and an AD, and they were like, you should be okay here, even though we've moved the rest of the crew a mile away from this explosion. And they literally had a fire blanket up there, and they're like, if you feel like, it really immense heat, just duck and put this blanket over yourself. And so I'm expecting like a fireball to come shooting into that tower, and then of course when it goes off, it wasn't anything too scary. I wish I had been a little closer, actually.
Would you like to play a character who's not a jerk, a character who's like smart and refined, and
Absolutely not. No, of course so. Yeah, I mean, I think with the Foot Fist Way, that was playing a character that was what he was, and I think when Hollywood kind of saw that, they kind of want more of that, so that's kind of, I think that I landed a few roles that kind of were hitting that sort of beat, and but I mean the bottom line is I just like a good story and I like a cool character, and so with Eastbound and Down, I think we really wanted to kind of play around more with some of the areas we were touching upon in Foot Fist Way, so that's kind of why we went back there to that sort of character. But that's by no means where the only kind of characters I want to play. Just right now, we've been having a good time with that sort of character.
The last year or so has been really big for you. You were in Tropic Thunder and Pineapple Express over the summer, and Foot Fist Way opened when, like a year or so ago?
Yep.
And so you've gone, and now you've got your TV series on HBO, so you've gone from, pretty big obscurity to, some degree of relatively sudden fame. So how is that affecting your life, and how is that affecting your thoughts on what it's like to be kind of famous?
I guess, I guess the main difference is I'm just not worrying about how I'm going to pay for my car insurance or health insurance anymore. I mean, I've still surrounded myself with all the guys that, I went to school with, and we all hang out together. And so, my personal life hasn't really changed that much since before all this began. I think I can just rest easier that I'm not bouncing checks right and left anymore.
Were you bouncing checks?
I was always living in overdraft when I was in LA. It was hard not to. I mean, I was just PAing or waiting tables, doing whatever I could do to kind of make ends meet.
Right, right. So you mentioned now you can buy health insurance. So do you have like a group plan? I mean, it's not like you have an employer per se.
You can get very good health insurance through SAG and the Writers Guild. So that's what I signed up for.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay.
All right. You sound like my mom. She's very proud that I have health insurance. That's probably the thing she's the most proud about with everything. It's like, good, you have health insurance. If something happens to you, we're not going to lose our home.
Well, Danny McBride, thanks so much for talking with us.
Cool. Thank you.
Danny McBride stars in the new HBO series Eastbound and Down. The second episode premieres this Sunday. Later this year, he'll star in the movie adaptation of the TV series Land of the Lost. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I love musicals and was really grateful to conductor and music historian John McGlynn for restoring musicals, going back to the original scores so that he could include music and songs that had never been recorded before. We're listening to the overture from his recorded restoration of Showboat. He also recorded restorations of Annie Get Your Gun, Anything Goes, and an obscure Jerome Kern musical called Sitting Pretty. We were surprised and saddened to read his obituary today. He died Saturday at the age of 55 of an apparent heart attack. He joined us several times on Fresh Air. We're going to hear excerpts of two of his interviews. The first time we spoke was in 1989, after the release of his recorded restoration of the 1927 Jerome Kern Oscar Hammerstein musical Showboat. McGlynn explained why Showboat is so important in theater history.
Everybody thinks of Oklahoma as the great watershed musical, the piece that, you know, finally integrated book and lyrics and music and dance and all of this. And in point of fact, many people, including myself, feel that Showboat in 1927 was the work that really did that. Showboat addressed issues which, for the time, were absolutely unheard of in the musical theater. You simply did not address issues of racial hatred, racial intermarriage, alcoholism, desertion by a husband. Things like that were just not part of what people went to the theater to see when they went to see a Florenz Ziegfeld musical.
How would you describe your overall vision in recording the complete Showboat?
It had always bothered me, both as an artist and as a fan, that Showboat had come to be known as the sort of light, frothy operetta. And I had always suspected that there were much deeper elements to it. And the more I studied the piece and the more I was able to get back to the original material and I saw what the full original scope of their conception was, I realized that this was really something extraordinarily dark and brooding and out of the ordinary. And in the recording, I felt it was absolutely imperative to restore all of the grit and the drama of the piece. There are several examples I can use, but the most important one, and the one that's obviously caused the most discussion, has been the restoration of the original language. The opening line of the show has always been a source of controversy. The curtain goes up on a levee in Mississippi. And it's in the 1880s, and the stage is full of these sweating black stevedores lugging cotton bales on their backs in the hot July sun. And the first words out of their mouth are, "Niggers all work on the Mississippi, niggers all work while the white men play." And Hammerstein wrote that word deliberately. It wasn't just the word that everybody used then and used thoughtlessly. He wanted to pick the word that would make this complacent society audience sit up and take notice and think about what life was like for these people 100 years ago in Mississippi.
Now, a lot of us know Old Man River opening with the lyrics, "Colored folk work on the Mississippi," or "Here we all work on the Mississippi." You restored it to the original, as you just described, but it caused quite a controversy within the cast that you were recording. A chorus of black singers who were supposed to sing it walked out. The baritone that was supposed to sing it walked out?
Yes.
Let's establish first whether they wanted to walk out.
Well, what happened was it was very unfortunate that because of scheduling and rehearsals, I was not able to be present at the first chorus rehearsal. What we had planned to do was to use the chorus from the Glyndebourne production of Porgy and Bess, because I very much wanted to have a black chorus for the black music in Showboat. They got to the first rehearsal, and they opened up their vocal scores, and of course the first word they see staring them in the face was nigger. Now, they did not know the show. They didn't know the context. They didn't know what the dramatic purpose of the word was. And they just went yipes, and they said, no way, sorry, we can't do this.
There's an irony here, I think, and that is that you ended up having to use a white chorus to sing Old Man River because the black chorus didn't want to sing the original text. And this is part of your attempt to get the most authentic recording possible.
Well, not only authentic, but I would like to think the most socially conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that happened like that, whether it be racial prejudice or genocide or anything, it can, if we forget about it, it can happen again. And I think it's very dangerous to try to pretend that things like this never happened.
In your recording of Showboat, you reinstated a very beautiful song, and I think this is the perfect example of the dark and brooding atmosphere that you found when you found the complete manuscript for Showboat. The song I'm thinking of is Misery's Coming Round, and this is a song that foreshadows the tragic turn of events about to happen. It's very beautiful. Why was it deleted?
First of all, at the first performance in Washington, the first preview out of town, the show ran over 4 hours, which was simply not feasible within the format and economic market of a Broadway musical. So things had to go. And anything, I mean, the first casualties, of course, were anything that was not absolutely essential to the progression of the plot. And Misery, as beautiful as it is 6 minutes of atmosphere and mood painting rather than something specific happens that moves the plot along. That's the practical aspect. The other side of it is that Florenz Ziegfeld was terrified of it. And Ziegfeld absolutely was so afraid that it was going to kill the show stone cold, smack in the middle of the first act. And I can see him, you know, at rehearsal in my mind's eye, you know, sitting there chewing on a cigar and going, it's a downer, boys, it's a downer. But it's very interesting about Misery because its cutting is tragic because its themes are used as underscoring throughout the entire show. And you hear all these references to this dark, brooding theme without ever hearing its original statement and knowing what its context is.
Misery's coming around. Them misery's coming around. I knows it's coming around. Don't know to who. Misery's coming around. Them misery's coming around. We knows it's coming around. Don't know to who.
Better hurry up that cleaning.
Do you think that your recording is an example of a trend in reevaluating the place of the musical theater in American musical life?
Boy, I sure hope so. I mean, so much of my career has been devoted to that, not just with Showboat, but with all the shows that I've worked on. When these shows were being written, nobody thought of them as great art. They were commodities. They were designed to make the authors and the producers money, and that's really all anybody thought about. Now, I'm convinced that in late at night in the dark recesses of their studies, the composers themselves did think of it as art. They knew they were creating beautiful music. But even so, they still treated it very much as a commodity. Orchestrations were not preserved. Manuscripts were not even preserved. If a song or a complete show wasn't a big hit, Nobody felt it was important to preserve it in case it were going to be reevaluated by posterity 50 years later. What was the miracle that created people like Irving Berlin and Richard Rodgers and Jerome Kern and Cole Porter and Dietzen Schwartz all at this one time, these incredible people? And artistry like that, and quite apart from the style has changed, but just that kind of artistry doesn't seem to exist en masse today. People just didn't think that it was all going to end. So I think now, you know, people are realizing that we've lost something incredibly precious and we better find it and reclaim it and preserve it as fast as we can.
John McGlynn recorded in 1989 after the release of his recorded restoration of Showboat. He died Saturday at the age of 55. We're remembering theater music historian and conductor John McGlynn. He died Saturday at the age of 55 of an apparent heart attack.
Now, little lady, if you'll step up to the parapet, I'll give you a lesson in marksmanship.
You couldn't give me a lesson in long-distance spitting. Anything you can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can be, I can be greater. Sooner or later, I'm greater than you.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I can shoot a partridge with a single cartridge.
I can get a sparrow with a bow and arrow.
I can live on bread and cheese.
And only on that?
Yeah.
So can a rat.
Any note you can reach, I can go higher.
I can sing anything higher than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
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 That's Kim Criswell as Annie Oakley and Thomas Hampson as sharpshooter Frank Butler in John McGlynn's recorded restoration of Annie, Get Your Gun. McGlynn's specialty was returning to the original scores of classic and obscure Broadway musicals, reinserting music passages and songs that had been deleted over the years and had never been recorded. My second interview with him was recorded in 1992, after the release of his recorded restoration of Annie, Get Your Gun. He told me why he restored the score of this popular show.
Annie, Get Your Gun, I should explain, exists in two entirely separate and discrete versions. There's the original show that opened in 1946 at the Imperial Theater in New York City, and there was a very famous revival supervised by Irving Berlin in 1966 at Lincoln Center. That production also starred Ethel Merman and was recorded by RCA Victor. And for that production, the original orchestrations were thrown out, new orchestrations were done by Robert Russell Bennett, and some of the score was dropped, a new song was added, the book was shortened, two subsidiary characters were eliminated entirely, and that version, what I would call the Lincoln Center version, is the one that is, in fact, the only version that is currently available for rental and performance. And so I realized that there was a real palpable need, a real reason to go back and record the original 1946 version.
You were talking about the 1966 version and how that's been the only one available in terms of the score. Let me play the overture, the opening of the overture from the 1966 version, and compare that to the restored version that you've done. And I think our listeners will hear that the 1966 version is very heavy on strings and harps, whereas yours is crisper and it there's more horns in it.
Well, you know what there is in the original that there isn't in the 66 version is five saxophones.
Right.
The saxophones were completely eliminated from the 66 version.
And replaced by violins, probably.
Yeah, and more brass.
So I'm gonna start with the 1966 and then I'll go to your new restoration.
Thank you.
how would you compare these two?
Well, first of all, let me say that I don't want to be seen in any way to be knocking the 1966 version. It's worth remembering, first of all, Irving Berlin supervised the 66 version, mm-hmm. and it was orchestrated by Robert Russell Bennett, who had done a large portion of the orchestrations of the original production. It was reorchestrated for one definite reason and a second reason that I suspect, which I didn't realize until last year. First of all, this production was designed for the New York State Theater. And that is a big house. And I think they felt that orchestrations were needed that would be louder, heavier, punchier, and more in the style of the 1960s. Broadway orchestrations, even though they were very peppy in the 40s, tended to be more delicate. By the 60s, we were into the age of amplification, and it was a huge hall that needed a great deal of sound to fill it. That, I think, is partly the reason. Also, I think it was felt that the sound of the saxophones, that whole 1940s sound, would sound dated to 60s mentality.
What's interesting is that it's the 1966 version that I think really sounds dated.
Now it does, because you know what it is? It's very interesting. I found that this applies to so many of these shows that people go back and doctor. It's what I call malice of hindsight. And when something is created new, you're simply creating it. You're doing what is in your heart, what is all around you musically and culturally. You are going with the flow of what you're in the middle of living in. You're not consciously second-guessing yourself. When you go back 20 years later, they did this with Showboat as well, and you try to do new arrangements which are not so much in the style of the 1940s as in what they think people think the style of the 40s was, it never sounds right. It always sounds slightly ersatz, slightly artificial.
Do you sing anymore? I mean, you have a small credit on the Annie Get Your Gun recording. You're on the reprise of There's No Business Like Show Business. I'm not sure if you're just speaking a line there, if you're actually singing.
I sing at rehearsal. I sing when someone's missing. I say modestly, a very pretty little teeny-weeny tiny tenor voice. But it was much too small to do anything with operatically, which is what I wanted to do. And I stopped singing for a very practical reason, which is that it terrified me so that, I mean, I would shake and I would vomit and, oh, it was just horrible. And I thought, this is no life for an adult human being. I'm terribly glad that I went through that. I studied voice for 8 years. I took 3 lessons a week. And I performed in college and all of that. I know what kind of hell singers go through when they perform. And that's terribly useful to me as a conductor. I can hear before it happens when a singer is about to run out of breath. I can hear coming out of the throat when the singer needs just that little bit of extra room to get over the register break for a high note. And I think it's one of the reasons singers like working with me so much is that unlike some conductors, I'm extremely sympathetic to the physical demands of what a singer has to endure in order to produce the sounds they do.
Now, I have to ask you about There's No Business Like Show Business, which is, you know, the anthem from the show. Mm-hmm. Did you go into this still loving that song, or was the song really tired for you, and did you have to work to make it fresh?
No, it wasn't tired for me at all, because, you see, I have a trick. Whenever I feel that something is getting tired for me, I avoid it like the plague, mm-hmm. and I go away from it. And that way it stays fresh. I mean, I haven't spent all of my life doing There's No Business Like Show Business, so it isn't old for me. Mm-hmm. Now, sure, you hear it all the time. You hear it sung at the end of every Tony Award ceremony, all that kind of stuff. And it's become so much, you know, a part of our bloodstream that you don't think of it. But when you're doing it in the context of the play and you're using the theater orchestration, you're suddenly, instead of just everybody sort of getting up and singing a song they half know, you're dealing with a song that suddenly has a very specific emotional and theatrical point, which is they are trying to persuade Annie to leave home, to leave Dark County, Ohio, and come with them, join the circus, join the Wild West show. And she's very unsure, so they use this song to get her excited about going into show business. So the situation was unique and fresh and had a dramatic need. There was a reason the song needed to be sung. And when you're working under those kind of circumstances, something can't get old.
Well, John McGlynn, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything the traffic will allow. Oh, and when you get that happy feeling, when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people, they smile when they are low. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. That night you opened and there you are. Next day on your dressing room they found a star. Let's go on with the show.
Our interview with conductor and music theater historian John McGlynn was recorded in 1992, after the CD release of his restoration of Annie Get Your Gun. McGlynn died Saturday at the age of 55. He also conducted and recorded restored versions of Showboat, Anything Goes, Kiss Me Kate, the Jerome Kern musical Sitting Pretty, as well as overtures and songs by Kern, Gershwin, and Rodgers and Hart. There's a new film just out in theaters about organized crime in Italy. It's called Gomorrah, and since it premiered at Cannes in May, where it won the Grand Jury Prize, it's received enormous international acclaim, sweeping Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Actor, and Best Cinematography honors at the European Film Awards, the continent's version of the Oscars. Our critic at large, John Powers, admires the film and says that it made him think hard about the different ways that movies portray gangsters.
Ever since Prohibition, American movies have been in love with organized crime. Our pop culture not only finds gangsters colorful and supremely quotable, bada bing, but it often flatters their thuggishness by endowing it with tragic grandeur. "The Godfather made our life seem honorable," said Sammy the Bull Gravano, adding that Francis Coppola's movie inspired him to kill even more people. Of course, Americans can mythologize Don Corleone or Tony Soprano, because for most of us, their activities feel safely distant. They exist as stories rather than living presences. Things are different in Italy, where everyone feels the reach of the mafia, whose power touches everything from their trash pickups to the highest offices in the land. Because of such proximity, the best Italian stories about the mafia, for instance, Leonardo Sciascia's brilliant novels about Sicily, are resolutely unromantic. They never get all sentimental about family. Nowhere is this clearer than in the new Italian movie Gomorrah. Directed by Matteo Garrone, this crime epic takes us into the world of the Camorra, a syndicate based in and around Naples that, despite being little known here, is actually bigger than Sicily's Cosa Nostra. Watching the Camorra in action, we see how organized crime can become every bit as crushing as a totalitarian government. Beginning with several murders, for the whole system runs on bloodshed, Garrone's film interweaves several stories. We follow a frightened mob bagman, a 13-year-old kid who joins the Camorra, and a tailor who's teaching illegal Chinese workers the tricks of high-fashion couture. The deadliest character is the most respectable, a sleek, silver-haired fixer who arranges for businesses to dump toxic wastes in fields where it poisons those living in the communities nearby. As we follow the action, we start to grasp the globalizing power of the Camorra, which deals in everything from trafficked humans to the designer clothes the movie show's Hollywood actresses wearing on the red carpet. More important, we get a harrowing sense of what it means to live under mob control. The Camorra poisons everything it touches, and in parts of southern Italy, it touches everything. Shot on location, the world of Gomorrah is one of pervasive corruption, violence, and fear, a world of harsh landscapes and dire housing projects that seem less a physical geography than a moral hell. Gomorrah is based on a powerful book by an ambitious young Neapolitan journalist named Roberto Saviano, who saw his own father badly beaten because he'd called an ambulance for one of the mob's victims. Fueled by righteous anger, Saviano did undercover reporting on the docks and at an illegal textile factory, and he even waited tables at Camorra weddings. The result was a passionate, highly personal expose whose visibility annoyed the mob's bosses, who were evidently not avuncular old fellows like Marlon Brando. These dons issued their version of a fatwa back in 2006, and 3 years later, Saviano, just 29 years old, is still living a life of bodyguards, armored cars, and safe houses. While Saviano's book burns hot, he's implicitly his story's crusading hero, Garrone's approach is cool, detached, and almost anthropological. He knows that in a movie, Saviano's feverish style would make Gomorrah exciting in the wrong way. Turn it into operatic melodrama or pulp fiction. Featuring no heroes, Garrone's movie is pointedly anti-mythological, never more so than in its treatment of murder. Gomorrah is actually far less violent than The Godfather or Goodfellas, but it seems more brutal, for Garrone offers no cinematically cool deaths, and nobody softens the blow with catchy lines about killing not being personal, only business. Highly conscious of how it portrays the mafia, Garrone's film serves as a useful antidote for those of us who watch and love movies that transform murderers into mythic figures. One of its storylines follows two dumb punks, Marco and Ciro, who like to quote lines from Scarface. The two run giddily wild in hopes of living large, just like Al Pacino's Tony Montana. I won't spoil things by saying what happens, but their story underscores one big difference between Garrone's movie and Hollywood gangster pics. Marco and Ciro watched Scarface and wanted to be him. Nobody who sees Gomorrah would ever want to be Marco or Ciro.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.